drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of a one-bulb light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues. Coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice, with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, 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 went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
That's Langston Hughes, and my guest is Arnold Rampersad, his biographer. Arnold Rampersad, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You described the poem that we just heard as one of Langston Hughes' first important poems and one of the first poems that linked blues and formal poetry.
Yes, Carl Sandburg, before Hughes, had done something with jazz, just very briefly in, I think, Jazz Fantasies, I believe it's called. But Hughes was the first poet to, in America, in the world, really, to look seriously at black music, at jazz, at the blues, at ragtime even, and to try to fuse that poetry with, or that music, that art, with formal poetry. And that's one of his very first poems. There he encloses the blues in a formal poem. Later on, by the end of the decade, that was written in 1923, I think. By the end of the decade, he was writing blues by themselves, as it were, just simply bowing to the musicians who had created this wonderful art form out of Afro-American experience.
Why did he write so many poems in a blues style or in dialect?
Well, in the blues style, I think he believed blues was more than just a musical style. He believed that the spirit of the blues was, if there was such a thing as one spirit of black Americans, that the blues best represented the spirit of black Americans. In other words, it was based in a sense of adversity, in a sense of suffering and tragedy, but it was converted through laughter and through the art of music. It was converted into something that was positive. It was emotion, in other words, from oppression to a kind of victory, always with laughter somewhere in the vicinity. And he thought that that amounted almost to a philosophy, if you like, of black life, and also a philosophy that that other peoples could turn to as they dealt with experience.
But his blues-inspired poems were criticized by both black and white critics. What kinds of criticisms did he get for these poems?
Well, his second book of poems, Fine Clothes to the Jew, which is very heavily a blues collection, I mean, that was absolutely savaged by the black critics. I think that they resented the fact that Hughes, in using dialect and in talking about people fighting with one another or of prostitution and so on, urban malaise, despair, whatever, that he was showing the bad side of the race to white people. But more informed critics, both black and white, recognized that something really significant was being done. An important Chicago critic, later a major professor of American studies, Howard Mumford Jones, pointed out that in using the blues, Hughes really was doing an extraordinary thing. He was adding a form to English poetry, like the sonnet or the ballad form. And I think that's absolutely true. And a number of poets since the 20s down to our day, both black and white, have continued to write blues poetry.
Langston Hughes wanted to make his living as a writer. Was he the first black American writer to be able to accomplish that?
Over a long period of time, absolutely yes. Paul Laurence Dunbar, at the turn of the century, had enjoyed a national vogue, and he did very well for a few years. But Langston believed from the time he was 19, 20, certainly by the time he was 23 or 24, that he was going to be a writer, and that he would exist simply by his writing. He lived until 1967. He held two temporary jobs, teaching in the Chicago Lab School at one point and also at Atlanta University at another point, 3 months each. Otherwise, he simply lived by his writing. So that meant that he starved a great deal of the time, but he stuck to his path.
My guest is Arnold Rampersand, who's written a two-volume biography of Langston Hughes. The second volume has just been published. I'd like to ask you to read Hughes' very first published poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers.
This poem was published in 1921 in The Crisis, edited by W.B. Du Bois. The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like rivers.
Is that a poem that you especially like?
I do. I like it a great deal. It comes out of a particular moment in Hughes's life. He was going off to Mexico to join his father. His father hated the idea that his son wanted to become a poet. His father, who was black, did not like black Americans, didn't like white Americans because of the way they treated him, wanted Langston Hughes to exile himself and go after money. Hughes said that he was crossing the Mississippi in a train on the way to Mexico. He looked at the sunset, the river, and it came to him suddenly that he was a part of a noble people, no matter how much they had been oppressed, what degree of poverty so many of them existed in. And this phrase came to him: "I've known rivers. We are historical. We have depth. We have spirituality." And the poem wrote itself, according to him. We don't know if it's true, but all the evidence shows that in fact it came out of that particular moment. And it's very interesting that a poem written at 19 years of age, just about, remained, in a way, his benchmark poem. I mean, I'm sure he was being asked to read it in the very last year of his life.
You got at something that's a real paradox of Langston Hughes' early life. You mentioned that his father really disliked American blacks, and Langston Hughes really disliked his father for that.
Yes.
He didn't see his father very much when he was growing up.
No, he did not.
But also when Langston Hughes was growing up, he wasn't always exposed to that many blacks. In his high school, he was one of few blacks.
That's true. In his high school, in the school before that, where he wrote his first poem in the little town of Lincoln in Illinois, and before that in Lawrence, Kansas, where he grew up. He was very often the only, or perhaps one of two or three blacks.
Yet he wrote so many poems celebrating the black experience. Do you think that being not among that many blacks during part of his childhood made him more aware of his blackness?
Absolutely, I think. Mm-hmm. I think he was exposed to black culture, say, in the churches, and one or two people who were very kind to him. And I think he early on identified the regard, the loving regard of black people as something that meant a tremendous amount to him. I don't think anything meant more to him than that. But you're right. I mean, he, going on to Columbia University, he certainly did not meet any large number of blacks there. And I think he was empowered by that, the fact that he was viewing the culture to some extent inside, to some extent, to a large extent from outside, made him really devoted to it.
It was in Harlem that he felt he really found his home. What brought him there?
Well, his father wanted him to go to Switzerland and study three languages and learn mining because his father owned mines in Mexico. Langston told the father he could do the same thing at Columbia, but he really wanted to go to Harlem because in 1921, Shuffle Along, with a musical, historic musical, had just opened. People were beginning to sense that the phenomenon known as the Harlem Renaissance was on its way. Exciting things were happening in that part of the world, and he wanted to be a part of that, where the Crisis magazine, Du Bois, was James Weldon Johnson, Jesse Fawcett, any number of people were there, young Paul Robeson later on. He wanted to be a part of that, so he went off to Harlem and fell in love with it. I mean, he wandered around the world a great deal, but 1947, when he finally got a little bit of money from a musical play, he bought a house and stayed there for the next 20 years of his life.
Would you read us one of his poems about Harlem?
This is a little poem from the 20s. It's called Aesthete in Harlem. Strange that in this nigger place I should meet life face to face, when for years I had been seeking life in places gentler speaking, until I came to this vile street and found life stepping on my feet.
When you read one of Hughes's poems out loud, do you feel influenced at all by his own style of reading?
Well, I don't know how well he read his own poetry, and he did not have a great deal of force, and he also did not like poems, he said, read in a far-off manner, a kind of stagey manner, and I think maybe I like a little bit of staginess in the reading of poetry. I like the way he reads his poems because what comes through is his humility about the poetic medium. He doesn't pretend there is more in his poem than he thinks there is. But I like hearing, say, Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee read his poetry. They're wonderful at it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were saying that you found Hughes's own readings lacking in a certain drama. I really like the way he reads with jazz musicians, and I think it, in a way, foreshadows some of the beat poets and the way they read their own work.
I think he was very proud of that. Carl Sandburg, of course, jumped in the 50s and said, "Oh, I was doing that a long time ago," but really, it is Langston Hughes who first made a great thing out of reading poetry to a jazz accompaniment. He saw jazz as the authentic 20th century American music. And his poetry just seemed to go naturally along with it. And I think yes, he reads much better when he has that jazz accompaniment.
Let's play another example of him reading one of his poems with a jazz accompaniment. This is recorded in 1958. The poem is Note on Commercial Theater. And playing with him is Red Allen on trumpet, Vic Dickinson on trombone, Sam Taylor on tenor sax, Al Williams at the piano, Milt Hinton on bass, and O.C. Johnson drums.
You've taken my blues and gone. You sing them on Broadway and you sing them in Hollywood Bowl. You mixed them up with symphonies and you fixed them so they don't sound like me. Yep, you've done taken my blues and gone. You also took my spirituals and gone. You put me in Macbeth and Carmen Jones and all kind of swing Mikados. And in everything but what's about me. But someday somebody'll stand up and talk about me, and write about me, black and beautiful, and sing about me, and put on plays about me. I reckon it'll be me myself. Yes, it'll be me.
When Langston uses saying, "You've taken my blues and gone," is he meaning literally himself or the work of blacks in general? And I ask that, no, knowing that he worked on the commercial theater and wasn't usually all that satisfied with the results.
No, he wasn't really talking about himself so much as the way in which so many aspects of American entertainment have taken parts of black culture, left the blacks behind, if they could. I'm talking now historically. Converted jazz into sort of a hybrid musical form that would appeal across the board to people who themselves would not really want to have anything to do with the originators of the music, the black musicians. He's talking about that, and he's hoping that one day blacks will be able to speak with their own true voices, that blacks will write their own literature and not simply have to read about themselves refracted through the eyes of white authors or white musicians. That poem was written in the 1940s, and perhaps the time has come.
There was an interesting tension in his work between his desire for commercial success and his interest in radical politics, and he found the two finally unreconcilable.
Yes, he did. In the 30s, I think you noticed that tension most of all, because, say, at the Karamu Playhouse in Cleveland, he is trying out plays which he, hoped would come to Broadway. At the same time, he really is in his most radical phase, 32, 33, 34. In 1938, the Harlem Suitcase Theater puts on essentially a radical play of his, Don't You Want to Be Free? Yet still, he's getting older, and he wants to make some money. He wants to have a house. Finally, in his lifetime, he wants to have a house.
And, but he wants people to read his poems, and what he was finding was the people who he wanted as his audience really weren't interested in the kind of Marxist-oriented poetry.
That is absolutely
true.
I would say that the masses of black Americans, he wanted to reach them, he wanted to stay with them, and they were definitely not interested in radical socialist poetry. That certainly is true.
I was very interested in your chronicling of his reactions to the black literature of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and the reactions of black poets and novelists to Langston Hughes's work as Hughes got older.
Yes.
For instance, he didn't like Native Son. He thought the story was too sordid and that
right.
Blacks needed heroes.
Yes. He felt it was the wrong time. In 1940, World War II had started, if not for the United States, for the rest of the world. But I think any time he would have found the realism, the ultra-realism of Native Son, just the depiction of its black hero as essentially a brute, that was just too much for Langston Hughes, who believed that the beauty of the people should also be pointed out. And that book, I think, does not give two sides. I respect the book profoundly, but he's right in that the book does not even suggest a possibility of a richer, more humane side to black culture. And he found the same fault with a number of later books by black writers.
In the 1960s, when there were more radical definitions of blackness and when a lot of black writers were becoming more militant in their writing, many of them really parted with Langston Hughes. He didn't necessarily like their work, and they didn't necessarily respect his accomplishments. Let me quote something that you quote, that Amiri Baraka, who is still going by the name of Leroy Jones, said in 1965. He said, "Let Langston and his ilk keep silent in the face of real artists. Theater in 1965 is not for leftover Lazaruses of the so-called Negro Renaissance."
Well, that's particularly interesting, since in the 50s, when Leroy Jones was living in the Village and Greenwich Village, and performing as an editor, sometimes as the only black, usually as the only black in a sea of white poetic voices, Langston often pressed him to take race more into account. I mean, he liked and admired Leroy Jones. He thought he was enormously talented, but he kept telling him, "You have got to look at your own people and what we have done, and listen to the blues and the jazz and so on." 5 years later, 6 or 7 years later, Leroy Jones has swept past past Langston Hughes, but of course we know that he has also returned in recent years back to a position much closer to Langston Hughes than he was in 1965 or 66, and he now speaks with great reverence for Langston Hughes, if only because he discovered later on that many of the positions he took subsequent to that nationalist episode were positions anticipated by Langston Hughes maybe 30 years ago. So he is among the most fervent praises of Langston Hughes today.
You raise the question of Langston Hughes' sexuality in your book. Some people thought he was homosexual, in part because he never married and also because he frequently hung around with young, attractive men. But you suggest he was probably asexual and that there's really no evidence that he partook of many heterosexual relationships or any homosexual relationships.
Right. I encountered the rumors fairly early on, and also the beliefs that this man was homosexual. I think the sexuality of a poet, of a writer, is very important for a biographer.
Why? Because some people would think, well, that's really none of the public's business. Why are you bringing that up?
Well, I think that biography is the story of the life, and sexuality is obviously important to the life. It may not be so important to the art, and I think it's not very easy to tell from Langston Hughes' poetry his sexual persuasion. But I think the biographer really is interested in every aspect, even those that's important, even if it's not related to the art. If, for example, Langston Hughes had run for office and for some particular office that had nothing to do with poetry, it would still be important. Important to a biographer. I tracked down this aspect of his life as best I could, as diligently as I could. I was certainly prepared to reveal anything I found that would be definitive or persuasive. Found nothing. The true story is that the man seemed to hide his sexual activity to such an extent that you have to wonder how much of it there was and why he was so determined not to let people know what he was doing in this regard. He created a family for himself toward the end of his life, but it was a family in which he, as a 40-something, 50-something, and then 60-something-year-old man, was essentially a son, because he was living with a man and woman he called aunt and uncle, who were not really related to him, but who had known him virtually all his life. So he believed in family life, that's for sure. He believed in young people. He clearly, in the 50s and 60s, saw some young men as his sons and tried to help them. But as far as I know, that was the extent to which it went.
Let me ask you to read one more Langston Hughes poem. Would you read Dream Variation?
Dream Variation is a poem that written again in his youth, about 1924, I would think. Dream Variation. To fling my arms wide in some place of the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree, while night comes on gently, dark like me. That is my dream. To fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, dance, whirl, whirl, till the quick day is done, rest at pale evening, a tall, slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me.
When Langston Hughes died at the age of 65 in 1967, do you think that he felt that his writing had been appreciated?
I think he did. The previous year he had been to, I always forget the exact name of this gathering, but it was a gathering of Pan-African peoples, artists of the world in Dakar, put on by Leopold Sédar Senghor, the poet president of Senegal. And you had people from all over the world, blacks and whites, and he clearly was regarded as one of the founding fathers of the idea of negritude, or of soul, if you like, in a literary and artistic sense. The New York Times talked about how young writers followed him about the way in the United States youngsters would follow a baseball star about. So he knew he had left his mark on world culture, particularly where black people were concerned. Whether he felt he'd gotten exactly his justice, I don't know, but he was to some extent a fatalistic person, so I'm pretty certain that he believed at the end that he had done well. He had done well, that he had lived up to the charge that his grandmother must have left him, and that was that he had to do something for the world, something that was noble, something that was good, worthwhile for the world, and he had done so.
You only have a few seconds left, but let me ask you. You must have asked yourself what Langston Hughes would have thought of your two-volume biography had he been able to read it?
I think he would have chuckled. I think he would have laughed. At his funeral, he requested that, in planning for it, requested that the last tune be a tune that Duke Ellington made famous called Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. And I think he would have believed that somehow he had reached across from the grave. He had an offbeat sense of humor, and he would have been amused at some of the mistakes in the book, too, because, of course, there must be mistakes, since no biographer can possibly recover the truth either about the facts or even the spirit of the person, not the 100% truth. So somewhere I think he is laughing at the effort, but I hope he's also glad that I wrote the book.